Everyone is on.
Introducing
Pretty Girls Love Real Estate. Stories of everyday women breaking barriers and building wealth through real estate.
Let's get it.
Boss. B-O-S-S.
Hello, hello. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Pretty Girls Love Real Estate podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Washington. And once again, I'm super excited for my guest today. I have Amani Woodby, another one of my girls from Project REIT, class of NYC 2019. Anyway, so Amani is, first of all, she's amazing, and she is Deputy Director for New Construction Finance for the NYC Department of Housing and Preservation.
Housing Preservation Development, yes.
Okay, cool. Make sure I got that right. All right, so she is like really in the inside, in the know about all of the development and everything that's going on in New York City, obviously one of the hottest and most expensive development markets in the country, in the world, period. So we're going to ask her about her journey in real estate as always, and just hopefully get a little bit of inside scoop of what's going on in the city now, especially during COVID. So, all right, Amani, how are you, my dear?
I'm so excited. I'm really happy that you invited me here. So I'm really, really happy. So I'm ready to jump in and kind of give some of my personal journey experience. So yeah.
Of course. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate it. All right. So first and foremost, so how did you get involved in real estate? How did you get interested?
So I was interested in real estate. And it's funny because my mom is an interior designer for Marriott. And so ever since I was little, she always, when I tell you, like, everything was HGTV this, and like, we used to, because she's like the interior designer, she has to like travel across the country and take a look at like new hotels, looking at the structures, designs and whatnot. And so I think she really was the one that kind of sparked that interest, just because also our house, like, because she's a designer, everything has to like look a certain way. It looks like you're in like a one of those HGTV magazines. And so I think really it was her who kind of sparked that in me. And it was like, I want to do something in real estate ever since I was like really young. Didn't know how I was going to go down that path, but I think it was, you know, once I went to Howard, and at Howard, it was only two tracks that they really promoted. It was either investment banking or consulting. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, okay, I know I don't want to be on Wall Street, but I do want to make a lot of money. But I also recognize that I also want to be helpful. And I feel like sometimes, you know, when you're in certain industries, it's very robotic. And so I, like I said, two tracks that my school promoted a lot. And I decided, okay, let me go into consulting. Let me test my hand. I did consulting for 2 years, worked for Deloitte. And then I was like, no, I really want to get into real estate. I've been saying this since I was a little girl. I was like, God, how do I like, you know, get my foot in the door? And as you know, like, this is a male dominated industry. Mm-hmm. And so it's really, especially as a Black woman, it's really, really hard to kind of feel your way into the door. And I started applying like crazy to like, something hit me and said, why don't you start off in the city? Because the private sector is just kind of, especially hard for African Americans to get into. So I was like, okay, let me start applying like crazy. I started, you know, literally applying like 10 applications. And then I was like, okay, God, I'm gonna let you, you know, figure it out for me. And then maybe like 2 weeks later, something said, do it again. So I did like 10 different other applications into other places. So then finally they called me back, and I started out actually in the division of tenant resources. Mm-hmm. And that for me was a humbling experience. One, it's like, that's where they put all the Black people for the most part, like asset management. And I was just like, okay, God, I'm in the door and I'm so grateful for that. But you know, I want to be in actual development. I want to be in new construction finance where the deals are made, where you're at the decision table. And I was like, but I'm so grateful that I'm in the door. I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I was very trusted in saying, you know what, you're going to show me the way. And so I was working for DTR for as a project manager there. Mm-hmm. I was working on like the rent increases, working with the developers to kind of like increase their rents on their Section 8 vouchers and all the different vouchers that we had. I kind of like ran the numbers, like the finance side of those things. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 2.5 years, and then something hit me and said, start applying. And I started applying. sometime in January to the new construction finance position, a position that a lot of people say, you know, you're not going to get that. Like, there's no Black people up there, which there was one Black person, and she was the DO there, director operations there. And she's been in that position for a while, but everyone else in the division was all, for the most part, predominantly white. And historically, it's been said that, you know, in HPD, and it's very well known because I'm a part of actually of our equality group at HPD, trying to like really get more minorities in. Mm-hmm. But historically known, they handpick people from Harvard, Yale, Wharton, like they're same folks, and they kind of rotate them in. And so I was like, God, I don't know how I'm going to get in, but, you know, I'm just going to listen to the voice within that says, just apply. I applied. It was so funny. The gentleman that became AC maybe like 2 months before, he was an African-American. And he was saying that, of course, he looked at my resume. This is what he told me on the other end. He looked at my resume. He was like, oh, she went to Howard. Good. So he was trying to get more Howard. Another gentleman, he picked up his resume. He went to Hampton. Great. Mm-hmm. So he was there for 6 months. It takes a while, as you know, to get into the city. So you got to go through the whole screening process, all that. And literally, when he picked up my resume, I had an interview with him for a certain position. And he was like, you know what, Imani, hold on tight. I don't think this position is right for you, but I do have another position coming up. And I really think you'll be great at that role. And so I was like, oh, great. I'm excited. Like, I'm going to finally get into the, you know, new construction finance. I'm going to learn how deals are made. I'm going to be working with developers. And it was so funny. He did just that. Like, maybe like 2 or 3 weeks after my first initial interview for a position, I end up interviewing for this, for my deputy director of completion and conversions. And what's so funny is it was at a higher pay scale, which was a blessing. And also, yeah, so it was like, oh, okay, you really did look out for me. And I'm just really grateful for this man. And he was there. When I tell you, I started the job, it was sometime in April. Let's say I started the job on Wednesday. He pulled me to the side and said, Imani, I'm leaving on Friday. This is my last day here. And I was like, are you serious?
You can't leave me.
But what he did was he did hire people of color. So he hired, in total, he hired myself. He hired another gentleman that's African-American. He hired a Guyanese individual. He hired one Pakistani individual. And then he hired one Latina. Mm-hmm. And of course, my division is pretty large. I think it's about on roughly about 100 and something of us. So that was a big deal, going from one African-American besides himself to like five others was mm-hmm. a huge deal. And so he said to me, and his exact words was, my mission here was to brownen up the place. He was like, you guys got to take the torch and move forward and figure out how to navigate the system. And he said to me, he was like, but I'm have to admit, the reason why I'm leaving is it's very racist here. Mm. And you have to understand, like, you have to be political. You have to kind of like figure out how to navigate that. And keep in mind, at the time, I'm what, 27 years old. So it's like, wow, this feels like a huge task. Like you're really put upon us to like really navigate a system, an institution that's known to like just shut out African Americans. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so that really started my journey in new construction finance. And I'm not gonna say it was easy, because it wasn't. Like, I faced a lot of adversity at HPD. I had even one of my directors say to me, he was like, you know, people of color don't get promoted here. What's your exit strategy? And I was, when I tell you, Jess, like, I was like looking at him like, what? How dare you? I've had other individuals say, like, you know, like, you're not gonna go into a certain level. Like, maybe you should think about transitioning into a different division if you really want to make more money. And when I say on that end, it was hard. It was hard to deal with those emotions, deal with not, you know, always have to remind yourself, well, I am good enough. And I think that's where Howard kicked in. Mm-hmm. That's where my parents kicked in, where it was like, no, I'm going to really push the envelope here. I'm going to do everything that I can so that I'm learning all that I need to learn, but I'm also like, you know, being a light, a beacon of light, how my assistant commissioner at the time was to me. His name was Nathan Simpson, by the way. So he was awesome. I have to give him a shout out, because if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be at HPD. So fast forward to now getting into HPD, getting into new construction finance. When I say, Jess, I learned a wealth of information. Mm-hmm. I know it was on one end, you have, you're battling with like feeling like I gotta go up against the world to show that I am the best and I'm this, I'm that. But then on the other end, you're exposed to so many deals. And this is why, and then it hit me like, wow, this is why they shut us out. Because Jess, as soon as you come out of working for, specifically in that division, I can jump into the private sector and I can make triple of what mm-hmm. I'm making and get cash flow off of some of these deals. So it's like, you get your salary and you can get some cash flow. Wow, that's, I see why it's like, you know, a dog to eat dog world there.
Right.
And so, like I said, I've learned so much. I've been on so many different deals. I actually closed my first deal, officially my first deal, from beginning to end, back in August. I closed 1921 Atlantic in Brooklyn. It was a 236 unit deal. So that was it. And Jess, that's where I'm saying to you, it took me 2.5 years for me to get on my own deal, for them to say, mm-hmm. you know what, we're going to give it to you. After pushing, after being so like relentless, like helping out on different other deals, but for me to actually push my own deals, mm-hmm. it was just like, I owned it. I was the person that's like, you know, able to move it forward and actually like, you know, close a huge deal like that. It was a $127 million deal. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm actually proud to announce that on Friday, one of the directors was like, yeah, we're going to give you your another deal. And it's a 400 unit deal in Brooklyn again. So yes, I'm excited.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. But yeah, what I learned at HPD the most was like, no matter what, like if you have, you know, if you're relentless, you gotta be relentless and just keep going and pushing. And like, also you gotta learn how to do the dance too. Like, you know, you can't be those stereotypes either, 100%.
Yeah, you gotta build the relationships and be friendly with some people to get what you want.
Definitely, building relationships, being part of Project REAP, like that, you know, all these different things that, you know, it creates a camaraderie. And like, even with people that we know, that was pushing me in the background and mm-hmm. watching others like, wow, like you're doing your thing. And I, you know, now it's like, okay, Jess is doing this. So that makes me feel like I can do it too. Like I can kind of move forward in this sector and kind of navigate it and make money off of it. And not only just making money, but also being happy at night. Like, okay, I achieved something. I kind of, you know, went down the track of helping people. And that's my personality. So,
mm-hmm. Well, you were always super helpful to me. So I'm super glad to see you winning and like being more happy. Cause I know like last year we were talking about this exact same thing, like how it's not that many Black people and you gotta like kind of walk on eggshells a little bit and do that dance. So I'm really glad that things are getting better. Really super excited for you. So let me just walk through just briefly that deal that you just completed in Brooklyn. Like, what are some of the things as far as your role that you had to do to get that done?
Yeah, so like we negotiate the terms. Of course, you know, when folks are coming to HPD, they're coming because they need a gap filled. And so we're kind of like the gap filler for these deals. Mm-hmm. So yeah, of course, you know, the city has limited resources. So the way we divvy out things, depending on the term sheet or the program that they choose, there's a certain amount of resources that we can give to that particular project. So it entailed a lot of like negotiating the terms. It entailed like negotiating, also like working with different departments. Like you've got to work with Department of DOB. You have to work with, in this case, they have Brownfield credits in there. So you're working with DDC and EDC, and I know all these acronyms, but you're working with across all city lines in mm-hmm. order to get more subsidy into the deal. And mm-hmm. so, of course, when you're asking anyone for funds, it can be very, very stressing, especially now in this climate. But you know what's so funny, Jess? This particular developer, they're actually MWBEs, which made it really cool.
Yeah, even better. Like, it's like icing on the cake that they're, you know, minority developers. So that's dope.
definitely icing on the cake. And what's so funny, and I think this is probably leads into something, like the reason why this deal got done was because of COVID. And because, you know, everything because of COVID, and two, because of the whole Black Lives Matter with George Floyd, and where the city now pivoted from, like, okay, we have to now look at minorities. We now have to look at how to help them move the needle. And so because this was a MWBE deal, and because, you know, everything, the climate was just, you know, making it, forcing that tension of just like putting the spotlight on African-Americans, that this deal closed in August. Now, these guys have been waiting around since 2017 to close the deal. It is now 2020. And this was supposed to actually be a December deal. So I was technically supposed to be closing it now sometime versus when they did. And again, it was because of COVID, it was because of George Floyd, whereas like our voices actually was heard. And I always say, you know, you start off, you think like some of the changes that you're making, sometimes it doesn't come off as is a big deal, but that whole George Floyd movement, oh man, that really, really pushed the envelope of like getting executives at a certain level to look at us. So, yeah.
Well, that's awesome. And let's keep it going. There's still obviously, you know, unfortunately, tragedy going on. And definitely, we always talk about it with REAP, like we're still like 1% or whatever of the executives in the commercial real estate world. So we just got to keep pushing and keep going. And so you said that you're on like the equality committee for HPD. So what are some of the other things that you've seen or initiatives that you guys are taking now to try to help increase that diversity there?
It's so funny. So it's myself and two others. Because of George Floyd, we decided to really push the envelope at HPD too. And so we were like, you know, we're sick of all of this nonsense. And actually the other individual was hired by my previous assistant commissioner. And we were like, we're not afraid to speak up. I mean, we're in our early 20s. We're in a position where you can speak up, because a lot of times, you know, especially when you have a family, you have all these different responsibilities, it really is hard to kind of like say your piece. But we were like, okay, the time is now. I think the climate supported it. We're in COVID where people, there's nothing for you to do at that time, especially at the height of March. There's nothing really for you to do but to pay attention to us. Mm-hmm. And so that protest meant so much, where it's like I said, two other folks that I work with were like, let's come together, let's start a movement. And so we started out and we decided, okay, we're going to have the agency put the pressure on the agency, put our knee on their necks to like actually make some changes. And so we started out with just the three of us. We started to then, reach out to our division and say, guys, you want to be a part of our group, where the steering committee, where we're trying to create change. We're going to come up with policy ideas. And it grew from just like us three, then it went out. Now we have different groups, different policy groups. So we have internal, external, and then we have a reflections group. The internal group focuses on how to revamp our internal policies. The external group obviously works on the external stakeholders, how we interact with the external group, like folks like MWBEs, how to get them in. And so in the reflections group, which is the group that I'm the co-leader on, that group focuses on how to remind people, like sometimes you lose sight of like, okay, white fragility, like what does that mean? How does that impact the workplace? Do you realize that you have these privileges that others don't have? And so, yeah, so last week actually we presented our internal policies to like the senior leadership team there. And so again, we're just starting out. It's only been happening for the last few months, but we're hoping that we can really, really create changes. And actually last week I also was to by my commissioner there that I'm going to be a part of like their working group so they can see how to actually implement these changes. But again, it's about speaking up, because some people are afraid. Some people don't want to be in the spotlight. You don't want to be seen as quote unquote, and I hate this term, but the black sheep. You don't want to be seen as a person that's rocking the boat, but it's like the climate is different this time. Like I just feel different from the other times where people try to like make things happen. And again, I really do believe in this weird way. And I'm sorry to hear that people that have passed away during this time, But COVID has really, really made people take a step back and like see things for humanity's perspective, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, you can't move around the way you used to. It's kind of like you're forced to kind of stay home. You're forced to like look at the news. I was never a news person, but no, now it's like you're forced to pay attention. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That's awesome. And then I guess it starts with the internal culture, like that person that was telling you, you can't, you know, go but so far as a person of color, like that is the number one problem within the organization. And then it kind of trickles from there based on like the people that y'all are selecting to get the new construction, the finance to be approved for the new project. So it all starts from within.
All right.
So from a technical aspect or from like things actually slowing down in the city, how has COVID kind of affected the just general landscape of development in New York?
Yeah, so for me, COVID, again, COVID's been a blessing in disguise for me. I don't want to downplay all of the health issues and things of that nature, but because you have to stay home more, now it's like you're focused on, especially affordable housing. Now the city is focused on more on housing because everything we're doing now is going to be home. Right? So you're working from home. You have your kids that are, you know, are at school from home. Like everything we're doing now is home, where our landscape is changing, where it's like, okay, we need to build more better affordable housing and like rehabbing. And so the initiative now has, I thought it was the focus was really like the mayor's focus was mainly on housing, but now we actually have more in our pipeline. Like for example, and I'm going to tell you, Jess, in our pipeline alone, it will take 5 years for us to catch up to it.
Mm-hmm.
We have 5 years of just deals, just sitting. So if we have 5 years of deals and that was happening pre-COVID, man, oh man, I can imagine like everyone is just kind of focused on this housing initiative. How do we improve? How do we, you know, create more housing for people, housing stock, affordable housing specifically? Because you do have a luxury stock out there, but now it's like you're home. Everything you're doing is home.
Right. And then like, you know, with COVID, it's been like a little bit of a mass exodus from New York, especially like Manhattan area. How has that kind of changed the game a little bit?
So true. So yeah. So now that's the other thing, because we do have a lot of luxury housing stock. But you also have a lot of people in shelters. Mm-hmm. Like specifically for HPD, the only way you're going to get a voucher at HPD is if you live in a shelter. You don't get vouchers, the Section 8 vouchers like that anymore, like not for HPD. Maybe it's different for NYCHA, but it really has, I think COVID has changed. You know, people are exiting, but I think people are diehard New Yorkers for the most part too, though. You know,
it's so expensive and you get so tiny living arrangements, but people can't go away. Like they don't want to leave.
They don't, you know, of course, like the age groups come in, like you have your phases, but at the end of the day, people come here to like, these are your dreams. And like, we were sold that dream and that dream still is alive. So I do see like folks exiting, but the folks that are exiting also are in like a certain age group where, you know, they have families again. But when you're like in your 20s, like you're really not focused on the things that you should be focused on, right? And sometimes, or maybe you should be focused on that. But yeah, I think now in terms of like the housing stock, it's a lot out there, but there's also a lot in shelters. So that's why I said earlier, we're starting to pivot the way we're looking at things. Like, okay, why do we have $3,000 homes, but we have X amount of people in shelters? So how do we kind of bridge that gap? How do we, for each family that are in shelters, that's $5,000 a month for the city. So is it worth it? Like, okay, I'm spending $5,000 for you to be in shelter, but the apartment is only about like 2,800, 3,000. Like, should I now rethink how we're doing vouchers? So I say the city is definitely rethinking things there.
And then it also goes back to the original problem we were saying, majority of those people that are homeless or in shelters or on assistance are African-Americans and Latinos and minorities in general. So it's like you can fix one problem by fixing another that's been kind of out there forever. So,
you know, cool. Jess, to your point about stereotypes, actually, it's not really African American, specifically in New York City. African Americans are not the number one, or Latinas are not the number one Section 8 holders and voucher holders. Actually, it's a different community that's the number one Section 8 and voucher holders. And it's so funny because we get all these stigmas, and it's like, that actually isn't true. It's like, you guys create this view or you know, just kind of create people in a certain light, when in reality is it's a different demographic that's actually really holding all the Section 8 and really like are milking the system in a sense. And I don't mean to say it like that, but I mean, we all to some degree need to kind of work the system and make it work for you. But yeah, it's just funny how we like kind of see it as a Black thing, like, oh, only Black people are in Section 8. But no, that is definitely not a true statement. Okay. Our people actually aren't.
Well, yeah, let me not downplay our own people, and that's not the truth.
Mm-mm, so they laugh at us.
They came up. We came up.
No. No, I think what it is like people need to understand how the system works, right? And once you understand how something works for you, you make it work for you and you come out of it. And I think a lot of times, I feel like specifically in the Black community, because I, like I said, I worked in the Section 8 department before. They, for example, a woman will come up to us with a head wrap on and she will like, you know, fussing and yelling. And I'm like, lady, where's your paperwork? Like, where are your W-2s and whatever? And she doesn't have it. And so she'll get off the Section 8 voucher. But then I know another individual that's, you know, they'll have this one lady that comes in for the entire community and their paperwork is all together. But you know that they have, like, their husband's has a business over here. But how do you prove it? If your paperwork is saying X, Y, and Z, it's not like I can fully prove that that's a lie and you have about 10 kids. You know, like, so again, I think sometimes we have these labels. And these false labels of who we are, but I think we also perpetuate those false labels because we come across a certain way. And it's like, well, you don't have to act like that. You can, you know, have your paperwork together and you can come here and we can get you going and everything will be copacetic and you can move right along. But I just feel like sometimes in our community, we just don't know how to show up and we don't know how to show up ready. You miss opportunities and then you're labeled a certain way. So.
Yeah, that's true. Hoping we can get better on that. But, and that is a good segue to another topic that we all love to talk about is Project REAP, which is helping us get better prepared in terms of just having the knowledge and then having the connections. Because like you said, real estate is a very relationship-based industry. You know, you have that old boys network kind of especially in New York City. So tell me about how Project REAP has helped you and what's your experience been since we graduated?
Yeah, I'll say number one thing that Project REAP has done for me is open my eyes to all the opportunities. Well, a lot more opportunities than what I thought. Like, you know, when we were taking those classes, I didn't think about like real estate in the Department of Transportation. Like, I didn't think about those positions there. And so we really did open my eyes to like looking at things differently as it relates to that. And then also I think for me, Project REAP has also connected us where you're like, okay, hey, I have a question about, you know, some real estate accountant question because I'm starting my business, right? I started my LLC. So I need to call up so-and-so to kind of talk me through this and recognizing that this person actually knows what they're talking about. Or I need to, someone called me up and asked me like, oh, Imani, what's happening on this deal? And should I take this GC? And I was like, quickly, no, absolutely not. He's gonna like, you know, he's in a lot of trouble. I was like, to save you millions of dollars, like I would not do that. And so I think for me, Project REAP has been like a give or take situation, an avenue where like you can confide in some people where it's like, oh, okay. You know, you're not the only one. Like, and it's so beautiful because you're not the only one, but you're the only one in your sector, right? Like, it's like one of that person there.
Right.
Like, and you know, this top executive in here or someone from HUD, like we know a person from HUD that we can call to like, oh, hey, you know, you were in that class, you know, let's talk about this really quickly. And she can bounce ideas off of me because you truly are one of the only in some cases.
Right.
Actually. So REAP has really, really been a good connector. Like, it's like touching hands. It's like, okay, I know I can reach out to so-and-so And people have been reaching out to me on LinkedIn, saying, hey, how can we connect? I'm trying to do this deal here and bouncing off ideas about that. And also for me, my personal endeavors, like long-term, I want to go down the track of development. I want to develop my own communities. And so having those conversations about funding and how can I, bring my funding together with other people, that's really been helpful too. So REAP is about connections, about, resources, tapping into those resources that you probably never even thought existed. Mm-hmm. 'Cause just like, you don't know what you don't know.
For sure. Like
someone else knows something and kind of sparks the idea and says, oh, well, what about this? Did you think about it this way?
Mm-hmm.
So definitely that's what REAP means to me in terms of like just opening my eyes to see things differently.
Absolutely. And like you said, the networking is top notch. There's people that you run into from all over the country at this point that are REAP alumni that you can connect with. So it's not just, just in New York City. It's like in DC when I go home, it's in LA, in Chicago, whatever, all these different places. When we go to the national conferences, we went to ICSC in Vegas and we just connected with a whole bunch of other REAP people outside of our class. So it was great.
I just want to add, because we all like money and people are actually getting to the bag. Like
really, yeah.
It's not like, you have a nice title but we're trying to really build wealth in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And really real estate is like the anchor of that, because you're always going to need somewhere to stay. You're always going to need to put your head down somewhere where your kids, and again, back to COVID, where the home is really now the central location of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's going to be all new world. Cool. Yeah. All right. So talking about a little bit about your personal aspirations for development, I know you've been talking about investing in Baltimore for a while now. So how is that going and what kind of made you want to pursue that area?
Yeah. So my stepmom is from Baltimore and I, was living there a little bit. Of course, the housing stock in Baltimore is very, 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 they have a lot of housing stock, excuse me. So I started looking at Baltimore because, again, like I said, I want to get into real estate. I want to find a community that is like, I can actually purchase at this point. And so I was thinking Baltimore. I've also been dipping into like Philly. Philly and mm-hmm. Baltimore are two areas. I actually have an agent now. I have things actually lined up that I am looking to purchase in the next few months. So I'm excited about that. And again, back to why Baltimore, why these smaller areas? Because New York is oversaturated, right? Like to really play in this space, you need millions of dollars. And when I say millions, not like the baby millions. You really, like I said, my deal was $127 million deal. So it's like, if I really want to make those strides, and how it works, especially for us, you start out with a few properties. Really, mm-hmm. And HPD has like this program, this MWBE program, where they try to foster, relationships with different MWBEs and get them through this particular program so that they understand how the ins and outs of construction work and how to finance the deals. But essentially, in order to get into that door, you have to have at least like 10 deals under your belt. And when I say mm-hmm. 10 deals, it could be something small, right? You start off at like a triplex, duplex, or whatnot. Do like a few of those. And then the next step after that will be then to come to HPD and say, hey, HPD, I did 10 deals. I have 10 triplexes. I managed those properties. I'm now interested in doing maybe a 50 unit deal with you guys or a 20 unit deal. Those type of deals are on the lower end, like I said, about $8 million, $9 million. And then you go from there and you're like, okay, they see that you did well in those particular deals, then they move you up to like bigger deals. And so that's my thought process, which is why it's like, okay, I'm going to go into a smaller sector, like a Baltimore, a Philadelphia, and like purchase, what I'm interested in now is like triplex. Purchase some triplexes or purchase a property where there's a commercial space at the bottom and start there. And then from there, move on to make bigger deals. So that's why I've been looking at Baltimore and Philly, for me to kind of start, get my footing in the door.
Yeah, both excellent markets. Both are really hot right now, but still affordable, which is the most important thing right now. So I know you're going to kill it. Let me know. Always interested in investing. So
we'll definitely let you know.
Cool. So on another personal note, you're now, you said you're studying for the GMAT, that test. So obviously you're trying to pursue grad school. And I don't want to jinx it and say what school that you said that you wanted to go to, but what do you think grad school and like, what do you want to pursue as far as your MBA and, you know, where do you think your career is going to go once you finish that?
Yeah. So I'm thinking finance and real estate. And the reason why I want to get my MBA is for a couple of reasons. One, I love my alma mater. I love Howard. But I also realize the realities of the world that we're living in. Sometimes you do need an extra, like, you know, kicker on your resume. Mm-hmm. And sometimes certain schools provide that for you. And then also back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of your connections, right? Like, certain spaces afford you certain connections. And so right. I think, you know, going down that track where I'm going to certain schools will definitely give me a leg up in those industries. And like this particular school is like hot in real estate. So that was the other reason. It's like, okay, to have this name on my resume, because you know, Jess, people pick you sometimes for no reason, right? Like they're like, okay, yep. I like the fact that you have Howard on your resume, or you have, you're a part of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated on your resume, or, you know, like, so these things I understand as a resume picker. I understand also I'm going to learn a lot, like that's a definite, but more so like you have to position yourself to be picked, right? You have to position yourself to be looked at. And I think that's one thing as African Americans, we need to just position ourselves in doing. And so, yeah, going down the track of getting my MBA, I also think it will provide me with the ability to kind of move in any circles, right? It's not like a specific industry. Like it's, you know, you're getting in finance and you're also getting in real estate. Those skills are transferable in whatever I do in the future. So that's definitely coming live. I've been studying. It is intense. I have to say that. Getting me back into my studying mode when you don't feel like it.
I know that's tough, going from, you know, working your 9 to 5 and then having to go home and study and do homework and stuff like that.
You're just like, oh, but I do have a goal in mind and I am going to crush it. So when the time comes.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're going to celebrate you crushing your GMAT and you getting into the school. And yes.
Definitely.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. So is there any other, you already kind of mentioned the project that you're going to get, but anything else on the personal side or professional side that you kind of want to share with us?
Well, I just want you to know, stay tuned. Jess, I'm going to be reaching out for sure once I start really, really moving on, like, you know, creating the community that I envision for us. So, yeah, that's really it.
All right. Definitely. We'll stay tuned. And we'll, once things clear up a little bit, we'll have to link up. I'm going to have to come back up to New York and check on my property up in New Jersey and all that kind of stuff and just hang out with everybody again because I miss y'all. So, all right. So let me just shift now to the last segment of the show, which is the Fabulous Four. And so it's this 4 questions I ask all the guests. So just whatever comes to mind, just go for it. The first question is, what is your favorite real estate book?
I have to say Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I think that's been given to us when you first walk into the door. So it sticks the most. So yes.
Okay. Yep. Great book. Everybody should read it if you haven't already. A lot of other guests have said that. So we keep hearing the same thing. If you haven't checked it out, definitely do that. So the second question is, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self just getting started with real estate?
Just getting started. Jess, if I, that's a loaded question. I think for me, when I was in college, and I was so grateful that I got a lot of scholarships. And what I should have done with those scholarship money, because I had, when I tell you, you know, you think of a college student, you're in your little 18, 19 year old mind, but you don't think about real estate that early sometimes. Like what I should have done with that, those funds early on, like there was one semester. And I always took this idea like stats, right? If I apply for 20 of these different scholarships, I know I'm going to get at least one. And 1 year I had like $20,000, 18, 19 years old, in cash. What did I do with the money? I didn't
blow it.
The things I did with it, like I was like, oh, I'm gonna pay off all my debt. So I paid off all my debt, which is not 100% smart. I shouldn't have taken all that money to pay off, you know, certain loans and whatnot. But it was like, I should have thought about it. Well, maybe I should put this in real estate. Maybe I should have, you know, kind of, because now it's like my money would have made me money, right?
Mm-hmm.
I got free money and it could have made me more money versus like just paying off debt fully. But you know, when you're younger, you're afraid of debt. And if I was talking to my younger self, I would have told her, like, don't be afraid of good debt. Like, good debt will help you. Like, you know, be mindful. And also be mindful how cash works. Because no one teaches you this, you know, when you're younger. Like, you're in these courses, but the realities of them don't really hit until you're in the real world. So that's experience. I would definitely tell myself, invest in real estate early. Start early. Get one property. I had a friend whose mom purchased her first property right out of high school. Then she purchased her next property when she was in college. And then my friend purchased her last, after that, purchased her property as her gift to self when she graduated college. Now she has, I think she has 12 properties and she's 30. So if I was talking to my younger self, take that money, that extra money that you have, put it into real estate. Don't buy no Uggs. Don't buy, like, girl, I was buying all, I thought I was, don't go out and party and just kind of like, I mean, it's a free for all. Like, and don't get me wrong, I enjoyed my last year experiences, but I probably just would have been smarter with how I use those funds and realizing that you can take other people's money to make you money. So.
Girl, man, especially DC and Baltimore 10 years ago.
Myself in the butt all the time. I'd be like, I could have had so many properties. And it was like 2008. Oh my God. Like, so many properties. So,
yeah. And then once you go through that process, especially if you were a young person, you go through the process and then you actually have more money. It's like, now I got to do it again. It's like, it's addictive, man.
Just imagine you thought you were the world. You had $20,000 in liquid and you only 18, 19.
Right.
It's like a Christmas store, like, you know? But yeah, I would tell myself to just be smarter with those funds and don't be too. And other thing, Jess, I will also tell myself, like, it's okay to not know.
Mm-hmm.
It is okay. Cause in the moment I was afraid, because I actually did think about the real estate thing for a little bit when I was younger, but it was like, oh, I'm scared because I've never done this before and no one's, you know, providing me direction here. It's okay to kind of go in a situation and not knowing, because you're so young, you're going to bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
You believe you're going to bounce back? You're definitely going to bounce back. But because you're so young, you can afford certain type of, you know, hiccups sometimes.
And plus, when you're also in college, people are just kind of more likely to help you. Like, they know that you're young. They know that you're inexperienced. Hopefully, you don't get taken advantage of. But people are more likely to be like, oh, come, let me put my arm around you and show you the ropes. Mm-hmm. So. And I love that advice, though, you said about good debt versus bad debt, because that's definitely an issue within our community. People are like, oh, I just don't want any debt. But debt is good if it's helping you to make money and it's leveraged to help you to reach higher heights. So that was definitely good. Third question is, what topic in real estate do you want to learn more about?
What do I want to learn more? I think at the end of the day, especially the space that I am, it's tapping into more resources, right? Resources for your deals. How do you leverage those resources? How do you leverage different, like, hard money loans? How do you leverage that? So I think for me, it would be tapping into understanding the finance aspects of it and how to, because certain people use their insurance policies to leverage real estate. So I think that's another avenue. I'm actually exploring that now with the agent. Like, how do I also, to be like a, in a sense, and I don't want to say I want to be like a Trump, but in a sense of how did this man hide all of that and only pay $750 in taxes? How do you do those things? Like, and that's where you want to explore how to, like, make your money work for you. How do I take this amount of money that I made today and then just allow it? I can be sleeping and it's making me money. So just understanding that aspect of it is for me.
Definitely very important, that cash flow and just asset planning and everything, tax planning for sure. All right. So the last question is, can you please give a shout out to another woman that's doing some awesome things in real estate?
Yes. So we have a few people that's doing well. I mean, we have Adeoye. She's doing amazing things in the industry. We have Kashima. Kashima's now in HUD. So I absolutely adore her. Hopefully, if she wasn't on your podcast, she could be the next one.
I'm trying to get her. She said that she's, you know, she's in the legal field. So, you know, she has a little more restriction. So I'm getting her. I'm trying to get her.
Okay. I'll pull on her coattail too. I think she will be a great, great person to kind of, you know, kind of talk things through. But yeah, those two individuals coming. You have Desiree Thomas, which I love her. She's killing it. In so many avenues. We spoke about her earlier because she knows how to work the room. And that's really crucial. Back to networking, working the room. So those three young ladies I have to kind of give a shout out to, how, because they're doing an amazing job in the industry.
Okay. Shout out to all of them. Hopefully got to get all of those on the show for sure, because they are crushing it, like you said. So, all right. So how can people, if they want to get in contact with you, if you want them to follow you on social media, how can people get in touch and kind of learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah, I have my LinkedIn. Of course, is, you know, type me in Imani Whitby. You can contact me there. I also, you can reach out to me. I have my, of course, my work, which is woodba@hpd.nyc.gov. And of course on my personal, if you, I'm totally open to like talking to people. So imaniwoodba@gmail.com.
All right, cool. All right, girl, this was been awesome. This was great catching up with you again, man. Yeah, I'm so sad that all this COVID is stopping us from getting together as much as we want to, but yeah. You know, still watching you guys from afar, and everybody's doing well. Everybody's still crushing it, or either doing even better now. Like you said, COVID has been a blessing in disguise. So I'm super excited about that.
Definitely. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity.
Thank
and
you.
It's amazing, and being a beacon, because you are actually, if I should have shouted you out. Creating this platform, I'm telling you, just like, you know, it means the world. It's like you are starting off a movement, and little things, little seeds that you're planting that you know potentially can make a true flower out of someone. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Appreciate all the support and kind words that I've been getting from everybody. So just inspires me to keep going with it. So thank you for taking your time to do the interview. Thank you for just being you and being a great person and just always willing to help everybody and help out your community and everything. So I really appreciate you. So I don't take up too much more of your time. But anyway, this is another episode of the Pretty Girls Love Real Estate podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Washington. Thank you again to my guest, Imani Whitby, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Thank you.